Welcome to the Leader, Manager, Coach podcast, where we share knowledge, philosophies, wisdom, and insight to help you on your journey in both sport and life. Introducing your host, Rob Riles.
Hello, and welcome to the Leader, Manager, Coach podcast. Welcome along. It's Rob Riles welcoming you to another edition. And today I've got a fantastic guest, somebody that I've known from afar for a long time, somebody that I don't know well personally, but I'm hoping that this next few minutes will allow me to do that and share his knowledge and information. And the gentleman I'm talking about is Keith Hackett. Now, Keith is a very famous English former football referee who began refereeing, I believe, in the Sheffield area. He's counted as amongst the top referees of all time. He's refereed a plethora of famous games throughout his career. Manchester City and Spurs, the infamous final. I think he was a very young referee then. I believe he was one of the first referees in the inaugural Premier League. I'm sure you'll put me right if I'm wrong on that. Since he's retired, he's, by the look of it, worked continuously. He's authored, he's got a couple of successful books out. Maybe he's got more. One is called You Are the Ref, which has been around a long time in terms of, I believe it was in the Shoot magazine that I used to read when I was a kid.
Absolutely.
Hackett's Law, a referee's notebook, and as well as that, written in The Express and The Observer, and has contributed enormously to the professional refereeing elite since his retirement. So, Keith, put me right if any of that's not correct, but welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be on. Everything that you've done in your research is pretty accurate. Obviously, it's amazing when you look back. 1960, I started refereeing. Little did I think that I would actually grace the fields of you know, in the English Premier League, Football League, and around the world as a FIFA referee. You know, as an active referee, it took me to 35 countries. And jumping ahead as the Premier League referee ambassador on the Premier Skills Program, that went up to about 100 countries. So when you talk about leadership, it really is all about, as I see it, passing on those skills. You know, in my informative years, as a young referee, there were other referees that I admired and looked up to. Jack Taylor, World Cup final referee in 1970. You know, I can remember sitting in the same room as him, looking across in awe at somebody who'd reached that level of football. Yeah. And then, of course, the joy of running alongside and being on the same field as players. And it's only when you look back, and I tend not to look back, but when I look back, you know, I've been on the same field as Maradona, you know, as George Best, you know, Platini, and many others. And at the time, you take it for granted. It's only when you look back that you're able to perhaps share these stories. I can remember sitting down, being invited to lunch by Neil Midgley, who was then, like myself, on the Football League and a FIFA international referee. And he said, "Hey, Hackett, what are you doing?" "Very little. Meet me at Burnham Park and we'll have a spot of lunch." And I went into the room. It wasn't a dinner or anything. It was just a table. And I was joined by, we were joined by Sanat Loftus and Tom Finney. And we spent the afternoon talking about football, reminiscing their careers. And of course, careers move in blocks, don't they? I mean, you look at the current block with Ronaldo and Messi, and you look back in the past with Kenny Dalglish and all the players that I've mentioned. So, yeah, lucky guy. And of course, recognizing that refereeing helped my career, my business career, because I was a sales guy. I started off in the steelworks as an engineer. I became a technical salesman and then became a sales manager and then sales director. When I reached that sales director level, people find it hard to believe that getting time off work was not easy. So my annual leave was about how many days do I require for football? And particularly in Europe, where you know, a game in Europe was 3 days. You set off
3 days
before, you did the game, and then you came back the following day. And, you know, the things that I look back on are madness, really, in the pressures of going out and refereeing New Zealand versus Australia in a World Cup game and receiving a phone call to say I've lost my job, having got a new one a few months later. I mean, I'm pointed to a very important game between Stuttgart and Feyenoord in the European Cup, and having to charter my own aircraft at my own expense for $2,000 to get me back. So, the FA Cup final, I always smile because I tell the story of there I am looking forward to the greatest game of my life.
Yeah.
And a guy from the FA comes in and says, right, Mr. Hackett, you've got to make your first decision. What's that? You've either got 35 quid match fee or the gold medal. Which do you want? I finished up with both because at the end of the second of the replay on the Thursday night, with everybody elated, not necessarily the Man City fans, but they had witnessed a very good game. The guy said, I've got good news for you. You've got the 35 quid and the medal. So that's football, isn't it?
Are you struggling to find that extra edge to help you stand out above the crowd? Separating yourself from the rest is often about personal leadership. Achieve your true potential and become who you really can be. The Leader Manager Coach Pro Course is a unique membership accessing the knowledge and wisdom from history's greats that will help you develop both personally and professionally to make you truly stand out. The Leader Manager Coach Pro Course. Access now at patreon.com Leader Manager Coach.
Absolutely, it's a lovely story, and it's just a blessing for me to listen to you because I, you know, gosh, Saturday afternoons once a year, that we all know that the FA Cup kind of lost its way in terms of how it related to the Premier League. But as a kid, it was like the day, made sure nothing else was on. I ordered my program that used to come in the post. I got the gambler to pay for it for me. I closed the curtains. It's, you know, so the old telly in the corner didn't get the sun on it. And then it was the players on the bus, the players in the hotel.
It was a whole day. It was a whole day experience. You know, so you can imagine that being part of that day is just really quite amazing. In that, you know, you've got people who you see. I mean, I met Margaret Thatcher that day on the first day, and you see the build-up, you see the players, you see the nervousness. And, of course, refereeing is not just about applying the laws of the game. It's more than that. It's an event. You're managing an event, security. You know, I mean, even modern game Premier League games, an hour and a half before kickoff, they're meeting the security people. You know, if suddenly the weather deteriorates or the ground deteriorates and you've got to call off, you can't, like, you know, you can do in a local park, just pick the whistle up and say, come on, lads, let's get off and get warm and to the pub. There you've got to have a 20-minute window where they can get police in position and various other things. So you begin as a referee to move towards becoming an event manager. And, of course, you're like the conductor of an orchestra. You've got a baton, but yours is a whistle and the verbals. And you've got to win the players over. You've got to work with them. And I think all too often I see, you know, I worked in an era where there weren't red and yellow cards. And I sometimes look back and say, I know why they were brought in, but have they achieved the result that you wanted to achieve? Yes, they communicate to the fans and to the media that a player's going to get a yellow card, a red card. But to some degree, it's taken away that role of management between the referee and the player to work with the player to calm him down. You know, I mean, everybody says, oh, you know, I listen to young referees saying, well, when I get you a yellow card, I do it from a distance. I don't say anything because it might inflame the situation. No. Approach the player, have two arms length distance away, look at him in the eyes and say, look, I don't want to change colour on this. So I want an improvement from you. And I think the art of communication, and you talk about leadership, that's what referees have to give to the game. When you see a young player bemused by what's happening, sometimes a lack of knowledge of the laws or putting, you know, under pressure that if he doesn't improve, he's going to be taken off by the player, the manager. So there's a huge human side to it. There's a huge management role in refereeing, but management shouldn't be an excuse that you don't apply the laws of the game and that when a foul challenge requires a red, it requires a red. But, hey, I was on the league list for 23 years and the international panel for 10. If I go just on the Premier League and the Football League, I didn't issue more than 10 red cards in that career. Right. And now, so that in a way, I always thought and believe, and I still believe today, that when a referee has to issue a red card, in a way, he has to take some of the blame. He has to review his performance and say, could I have done something better to take the heat out of the situation? Yeah. Because the aim should be 22 players on, and at 90 minutes, 22 players come off, having enjoyed a game of football.
So, Cracky, there's so many things I want to chat about. But look, so you started at, let's say, 1960. We're now, you know, 2023. So, but 60 plus years of working as a you know, a referee, either actively on the field or, you know, being the guide for others. And Pat, okay, here's my first question to you: did you set out in your young days with a style that you wanted to bring to the game? I mean, there are referees through the ages, if you've been a football fan, if I can use that word, who, you know, have got a style about them, whether that was a Jack Taylor, the strict Jack Taylor, or Clive Thomas, for example, who Clive the Book, as they called him, because he was going to, you know, Bob Mathewson. I mean, you're talking people a long time ago, but you know, like, he was kind of, for me, was like the friendly uncle who'd kind of go round and say, come on, son, you can do better than that, and let's not have any more of that, which is probably what you're talking about. So did you set out with something, Keith, or did you just do what you were doing and let it evolve?
No, it was more than that, because I've mentioned a sales background, and that I became, you know, a member of the Institute of Marketing, where in business terms you have to plan, and if you're developing a new product, you benchmark that product against other manufacturers. Is yours going to be better? How can you make it better? Do I need a blue car or a red car? You know, that sort of scenario. So for me, the referees that you've mentioned are the ones that I followed very closely. So I like to think that I was building a mosaic of their strengths and adding them to mine. And all of a sudden, it's a little bit like a player, isn't it? When we first saw that Cruyff turn, we went, wow, that's different. And then what we've seen is it's natural now within the game. So in a sense, we all copy but we have to copy the good bits. And you know, I work with and alongside some excellent referees. And yes, I ran the line to Jack Taylor. I can remember in a very difficult game, Leeds United versus Arsenal. And it felt hot even from the touchline.
Brutal. Yeah.
You know, and you're watching these things going in. And there was just a calmness. And then just before half time, there were three challenges right close by me, and I'm going, I've got to give the flag, and I hit the flag as though it was going out of fashion, and we get in the dressing room and Jack just said, thought you were getting a bit busy, son.
I love it and you
suddenly go, I know instantly what he meant. With Clive Thomas, I ran him the line at Burnley. He was an outstanding referee. For whatever you want about him, this guy could referee. He had a huge ego. There's no question that his ego was, you know, you suddenly go, he wants to be the star. And at that particular period, every time you watched him on television, he finished up with five or six yellow cards without, you know, or cautions without even thinking. And at Burnley, he decided, you know, I arrived at Burnley and I'm the linesman. I go to the dressing room and you then have to report to the main entrance. And I've gone into the main entrance and the guy, I'm there. And Bob Lord, who was then the owner and you know, well-respected guy, said to me, I suppose you're looking for your mate, Mr. Thomas Fancy Dan. And I have gone, pardon? He's got 12 mates. He said, bloody come and fill the ground next time. 12 mates he's got organised. He wanted 12 tickets. And you know, he refereed the match. He had to caution somebody. It was Burnley versus Middlesbrough. And Jack Charlton, I think, was the manager of Middlesbrough at the time. And he refereed, I thought, really outstanding performance. You could hear him talking to the players. He was in charge. And he came off because he'd actually cautioned two or three players and he didn't want to. He threw his kit in the corner, got a shower, didn't say anything, just got dressed and went, cheerio, and off he went. And I'm suddenly... So for whatever we might think of him, he was a passionate guy and a very good communicator. And I think that you learn by that. You know, sometimes people have said to me, because as a young kid to refereeing, I was refereeing mature guys in the steelworks and all that as a youngster. And in a way, you suddenly built in like a bit of, I've got to show them how strong I am. And in a way, you became a very strong referee, but sometimes perhaps a little more facially. And from a body language point of view, you learn afterwards, I was probably a bit aggressive in my approach. You know, next time you do that, you're in. And those sort of things. But I think you build your reputation quicker being a strong referee than being a weak one. So I was a pretty strong one. But you mentioned Bob Mathieson. He could eat forever. I mean, I've never seen anybody eat so much as Bob Mathieson. But when he came in the room, he was like George Courtney, a colleague. Instantly, the room was full in that he just had an aura around him.
Yeah, yeah.
Jack Taylor was quiet. He, you know, very conservative with his words. He probably thought as a butcher, he couldn't say much. But when he did speak... And you know, when I became the boss of the PGM Oil, the first thing I did was I phoned him up. And he says, what? And I said, look, I'm working for the Football League. I said, I know you are. But I want you to come and meet referees. I want you to come to our annual conference. Don't worry about the cost. We'll pay for you. And him just being around people was something special. And one of the things that I did that I was really pleased about, I got involved with the National Football Museum. Don't ask me how, but I did. Not just from a periphery point of view, Dr. Moore, who was the guy who set it up in Manchester, and we were doing You Are the Ref things there. And I sort of suggested, could you've not inducted any referee into the National Hall of Fame? Why couldn't you do that for a referee? And sadly, he passed away before he received that award. But they asked me the museum to present it to his wife. And I always think that...
This is...
Jack Taylor.
Jack
Taylor's wife. Yeah. And you suddenly, you know, he gets inducted posthumously into the Hall of Fame. And I felt very proud at that moment that I was handing over, a token award to his wife, but an important one in terms of recognising his services to the game. You build your reputation on a myriad of referees and you're fortunate to be close to them and listen. And then you see how they interrogate the game. But in terms of advancing my knowledge, I was appointed to the Olympic Games in 88 in Seoul, in Korea. And I was around a lot of referee coaches, not referee coaches, but coaches of athletes, you know, and all of a sudden, nutrition, scientific training, you know, I mean, I used to get up in the morning and 3 or 4 days a week and run forever around a football field close to where I'm living now. And it's only when I knew that I felt knackered that I'd done my training stint. And then when I started following a program of a sports scientist that I got and met in Seoul in Korea, I suddenly felt I was cheating.
Yeah.
But what he said to me is, what you're doing, Keith, is you're actually training, but you're not training for any outcome.
Yeah.
It's all endurance. And of course, when I became the boss of the PGMOL, following Philip Don, I was the development manager. I brought in sports science, nutrition, vision scientist, taking away the perception of referees' performances and moving into a world of reality. So that if somebody like Alec Ferguson says Alan Wiley's not fit publicly, I could demonstrate to him that of the 22 players on the field of play, Wiley was in number 3 position. He didn't look athletic because he wasn't a 23-year-old lad running around the football field. But in fact, his statistics proved the fact that he was fit. So again, that's part of the process of referee development.
Yeah, beautiful. You talked a little bit there about ego, and I don't think you can be involved in professional football. And ego's a funny word. It's crikey. It's got bad connotations, but then there's people who say, it's part of the, if you haven't got an ego, you're not going to achieve anything. So I'm not a professional psychologist, so I'm not going to get into the definition of it. But I think one of the things that really irritates players, managers, and supporters is when a referee appears to want to be the star of the show. I think, without pulling any punches, Keith, I think, and you've already kind of alluded to that in a way, that is what the game isn't about, and it actually really has a negative effect on the, you know, the other participants in the game. What do you think that there was a time? I kind of think when the Premier League came on and the pressure kind of went up, if I can use that phrase, and referees became professional in terms of full time, and you'll know all the dates and all this, and you were heavily involved in it. That it was hard to find the balance for them not to be the star of the show with the demands on them, kind of thing. But you know what? I'd love to hear what you think about that and how that's managed and so on.
Well, I think that one of the battles that you always face in refereeing is confidence can be seen as arrogance. And in a way, your body language has to be positive. It's got to ideally be neutral, but it's got to be positive on the basis of, you can't be a shrinking violet in a corner. You've got to actually manage an event. And so it really is important that the study of body language, knowing that, 55% of communication skills are through the physical bit rather than the verbal bit. You know, the verbal is only about 7% in terms of communication. So I think that you're right. The other change is that we've got to recognize that in the era that I started in the 70s, there were people like Ken Burns and Ken Dagnall who were terrific referees. Rarely did they appear on television. People didn't know that. Then you start to get a match of the day, and we figured for 20 minutes, we never had a whole match. We might have got it in the FA Cup. Our exposure came when we did a final. And then when the Premier League started to evolve, and not in those first years, but, some years down the line, certainly when I took over, we were operating under a minimum of 22 cameras. So you became part of that process. Mm-hmm. And I think that people tended to think that Graham Poll, for example, was arrogant. Mm. And there were some times when he bordered that, even in my view of him. But in fact, when he was confident, he was probably the most confident referee that I've worked with. So I think it's, I don't think they want to take away from the game. I think that sometimes the referees come into focus more because of the fact, the way they communicate, the way that their performances are examined, you know, and the pressures that they come under. But then that's why we made them professional. Yeah, and that's why I brought, you know, the sports psychologist would talk openly about body language, style, how not to confront. You know, you'll see lots of referees now holding their hands out horizontally with palms facing down, saying, look, I'm not in conflict. A small body language action that hopefully reduces the tension. But, you know, in my day, there was an affinity with a player because the player was, to some degree, still in my eyes, the star of the show. And he has to be the star of the show, that player.
Of course.
Her as well. So I think it's how you recognise your position within that, knowing that you've got to manage the game. Mm. And I think sometimes I do see referees that I think, what are you trying to do? I mean, I think we saw that in the World Cup with that nonsense referee that was flying cards around like confetti. And look at me, I want to be the star of the show. I think it's rare, but I think it's perceived more by the spectator who's probably having decisions against them and all that guy goes. I mean, I don't think anybody's got a real vision as to how referees feel when the game doesn't go well, the way that they interrogate the performance. And I brought in a level of accountability that's actually been watered down since. Perhaps looking back, I might have been too severe when I was boss of the PGMOL. But if I felt that a referee was not up to the standard, I was doing exactly what a manager in a Football League club or a Premier League club was doing, saying, well, okay, you're a good player, but you're not quite good enough for the Premier League. You're not quite good at that elite level. And that's when the decisions have to be made, that you say, right, okay, I'm either taking you off the list or I'm giving you the opportunity to go down a level. And I think that accountability has to be part of the system. They've got to earn the money. They've got to deliver on the performance. And I think that people have to communicate that there is a...
Because
of the number of decisions they're making, they're going to make errors. But in the main, the error levels are relatively low.
Yeah. Is there... There isn't a profession, is the key. And this is a bit of a rhetorical question, but I think you know what I'm saying. And where there's so much pressure because of the instantaneous need to come up with the correct decision. And obviously, we might touch on the additional helpful, in inverted commas, benefits of, you know, VAR, et cetera, and the fourth official and so on. But it is that, is it, I'm asking you really, is it, it's that pressure, isn't it, that you've got 22 cameras, you've got maybe millions of people around the world, if it's a stage event, you've certainly got up to 100,000 people in a stadium, you've got more money resting on the decision than you've got possible uprising. I mean, there's places around the world where, you know, we know that riots happen over football games in a few places. Yeah. It also used to happen in this country and probably does to a small extent. Mm. We know that because of emotion. So, we know that football's got that ability to change people's lives, and you know, the horrendous statistics that tell us that abuse goes up when a team loses for the supporters of that team. I mean, it's no wonder, you know, I don't suppose you can have football being the greatest, okay, the favourite sport of the world without that other side of it. But back to it, the pressure on a referee is... It's almost unparalleled, isn't it, really?
Well, I think if you look at it from a business point of view, you have to say, if you know, which business in the world would actually allow somebody to come in and take control for 90 minutes of their business and take control of their employees? Because effectively, That is what we're doing.
Yeah.
What we've also got to recognize is that pressure can be relieved, and it's how the match official deals with the pressure. Now, look, if you're the young lad who's just started refereeing, that's pressure, because you don't fully you know the laws of the game. You pass the test, but you don't know how to apply them. And you're going out on a Sunday morning, and it's like now in the modern game, even at junior grassroots level, there's two dozen parents who all think that they're watching Howard Webb referee a football match at grassroots level. And their expectation is they want that referee to do the same. And he might only be, or she might only be 15, 16, with little experience of dealing with people less applying the laws and dealing with pressure. What you do over the years is you evolve. You have coping mechanisms that switch off. First of all, I know the teams, I know the position, I know the players, and I know the hot spots of certain individual players that might give me a grief, and I've got to manage them. And there are ways of doing that. You know, I might have gone up and said, "Hey, my lad's in the stand. He thinks the world of you. Are you going to spoil it for him? Because I've brought him to the match just to watch you." And yeah, you might be tickling somebody's ego, but you're actually having a conversation. I think that despite what people might say, I think if fans see a referee putting in a great deal of physical effort, being close to play, they'll forgive the odd incorrect decision because they'll say he's a human being. What they don't like is the guy that you've touched on, that's overly arrogant, that's lazy in his approach to the game, and leaves himself open to errors. And, of course, that exposure is greater because television will replay it, not in the screens in the stadium. And this is the naivety of those people that now are in football, a lack of understanding of how technology should be used. You know, I'm the guy that brought in goal line technology. And when I started talking to Hawkeye, I said to them, the brief is very clear, less than 30 seconds for a decision. And I don't want a human being involved. They go, "What?" Well, all I want you is to say to the referee, it's a goal. I don't want you to say anything else.
Yeah.
I don't even want you to do it verbally. I want it electronically. Yep. So it's laying down the criteria. And you know, technology it gives a degree of balance. You know, a referee doesn't have a second look. Television, at the press of a button, the guy can actually swing an angle on television that you see that the referee doesn't see. He's only got one pair of eyes. He may have got somebody running in front of him. And the whole aspect of VAR is the guys who brought it into the game, and I'm a supporter of technology, but they've not sat down and thought the thing through as well as they could have. And the way you develop and evolve that is through moving the criteria and laying down a very clear criteria. But you cannot introduce a piece of technology that doesn't communicate with a person who's paid the 45 quid or 10 quid or 5 quid to watch a game of football. They have to be involved in the process. I cannot understand why it's taken probably 6 years for somebody at the IFAB and FIFA to suddenly decide, "Oh, we better communicate some way to the fan in the stadium." There's nothing in an action sport, football is, there's nothing worse than actually keeping the participants, i.e. the players and the spectators, not aware of what's happening. So these are long breaks in which all it gives is a picture of indecision. You might come to the right decision, but that delay factor has put doubts in everybody's mind. Whereas if you said, "I want you to look at that offside," and you hear the referee and the VAR saying, "Look, I'm getting the clip up, I'm looking at it, I'm drawing the lines are clear, he's offside." And the audience can hear that, the fans can hear that, the referee at the sharp end, right, is not abdicating his responsibilities. He's the guy that makes the decision and says it's offside or it's not offside, or it's a penalty kick or it's not penalty kick. But because there's this, you know, in the modern age, putting up a slide that says VAR is looking at offside. Well, we know he's looking at offside. He's looking at something. So the lack of information flow to the fan puts something in doubt in relation to the decision-making process. And I think it undermines the referee. Now, against that, what VAR has done is it's created a group of lazy referees.
Right.
If you give a referee an excuse for not making a decision, he'll not make it.
Keith, do you think it's lazy, or do you think it's a way out of the courage? Is it a courage issue? Is it like I'm off the hook here?
Yes, I think there's a touch of that. There's also perhaps a relative indecision in the process, i.e., you know, when you're given a penalty kick, you don't even think about it. What I think we've lost in recent years is this gut feeling that a referee develops over many years. It's a little bit like anticipation. You know, you develop your cognitive skills because, you know, good managers see things before they happen. There's nothing different in refereeing. What you're trying to do is you're trying to not be clever. You're trying to say, right, it's the what if process. You know, what are the likelihoods? So if you begin to read a player, you knew that, you know, players like Glenn Hoddle, when he picked the ball up and he was going to spray it out, you knew there was a good 90% chance that the ball was going to be delivered and the attack was not going to break down. So you knew that when he's on the ball, you've got to be running because you've got to get to the dropping zone. And this is no different. So if you're refereeing Manchester City now and De Bruyne picks the ball up, you know that 99 times out of 100, he's going to deliver. And therefore, it's anticipating what he's going to do, having built in the knowledge of what he's doing and beginning to understand the players. And this is why when you have a group of professional referees, it's not just about getting them fit physically. It's about preparing them mentally to deal with the pressures, because I'll tell you, there are no pressures. There are no real pressures because the adrenaline flows. The adrenaline lights you up and you're on it. And, you know, where you've got to make certain that the referee can step up a gear or drop down and adjust to the game in front of them, you know, it's like that conductor of the orchestra. He's got a score in front of him. Is the beat going to increase or is it going to decrease? And the same applies in referee. You know, a goal has been scored or you've issued a yellow card or a red card. You've got to be in the face of players. Your proximity to play has got to be, you know, you're not. I liken it to a fire engine. If you're a fire engine, you need, and you've got water on the tank, the fireman wants to put the most amount of water into the fire, the zone of the fire, the hot spot. Mm. If he stands or parks his bus or fire engine in the next street and starts to spray it from a distance, it oxygenates the problem. And I think sometimes referees are not being given that coaching and training advice to say, look, kick on. And if you read a lot of what I write, I'm critical of certain referees who are lazy in terms of their physical movement. The reason being is that the process of a referee is to see, recognize, think, and act. And I tell you that when I've looked at decisions that have been made incorrectly, invariably, it's that see process that's the problem. They're not in the right position to get the viewing angle to see what's happened, yet the producer of the television program presses a button and he can press three or four buttons, or he's got five or six screens in front of him to say, this is the decision. Now, that's where VAR should be operating. VAR should be saying, that's a free kick, that's a foul, whatever.
Are you saying here he's seeing in this discussion, which I think we see in a lot of industries, and I certainly see in mine. I'm a coach. I'm a football coach. I'm a rehabilitationist, a physiotherapist as well. And a lot of the young people that come through today have got the advantages of all the new technology, and they therefore they don't have to go through the processes that I went through, you went through, and therefore they haven't developed those skills. And I think they are lesser because of that, in terms of their, you know, it's a harsh thing to say, but I do believe that, because I think, yeah, we could use the word lazy, because it's made them lazy, because they don't have to do it, because it's done for you. Yeah. And but is that as a professional, you'd rather go and have a consultation with, or have somebody on board who has got all that experience, because you can't buy it. And it's a kind of, it's a preferable product, Keith, to somebody who can do it by paint by numbers, you know?
I think one of the shortfalls is the fact that when I look at any sport, and I've mentioned the Olympic Games, I didn't realize the impact of a good coach on an individual athlete, the guidance, the honesty, the discussion, the support mechanisms that a coach offers an athlete, that relationship is developed, the trust is developed over a matter of or a period of time. I think that if we look at English refereeing now, I think it's weak in terms of coaching. I don't think it really has. It did have, because I was beginning to build a team of coaches that were dismantled by the guy who took over from me, which I thought was very sad. And you know, the coaches that I'd helped select, and the Football League had already appointed some, were different skill sets, different types of referees, looked at it from a different perspective. I think that because of the shortage of referees that we have in England, and the people that we're attracting into refereeing, this is where the problem lies.
We're
bringing in, look, I don't want to be too critical. We've got youngsters who want to become referees without any playing skill sets. And all of a sudden they take up the whistle and they see it down one line and one route, because that's how they're being taught. I had 12 years in local football. Believe me, if I refereed poorly, there was always the risk that I might get thumped going up.
Yeah.
It never happened, but you know, that was the pressure.
I mean, I can
remember sort of sending a player off for a violent act, and that evening on the way home, I decided I'd call them fish and chips on the way home, and I was in the chip shop when I was threatened. You know, and you suddenly go, yeah, fine. But the thing was, I went outside and met that guy. And whilst we were eating fish and chips, we had a debate and discussion. We shook hands and I came across him. So I think that it's a lack of maturity and understanding. And I don't want to, you know, if you do not explore, you know, like you've mentioned Bob Matheson, and people say, who's he? And he was a Bolton-based referee, but do you know what? He was a player. And he acted like a player. And you know, I ran the line for Mick Lowe in Sheffield and got to know him really well. He and George McCabe, they were professional players in their A-day. And I think this is one of the things that the mix of refereeing, the input of referees, you know, I'd sit at the referees meeting, and alongside me would be a guy, and he's still got plaster and paint on his trousers. And he'd go, bloody hell, I'm trying to finish a job here, and I've got to come to this meeting. Mm. And he would say, you know, if you had a toffee-nosed guy in front of us giving us a bit of a talking to on his career and how good he was, he'd say, hey, just a minute, let's talk about refereeing, because I'm here to learn. I'm not here to learn about what you said.
Yeah.
And I think this is, in a way, you get what you invest in. And when you look back, you know, the Premier League decided to have professional referees. And I brought on sports science and opened my eyes to other aspects of refereeing, sports psychologists, and what impact they could do. All those sort of things that you're adding into the mix to improve the individual. And they're getting coaching skills from different people. And then you face different challenges. I had one referee, you know, he lived in the Potteries, and you couldn't wish to meet a nicer guy. And on the way to the football match, I used to say to him, "What you have?" And I used to go in Little Chef and had eggs on toast. That was my pre-match. And he would say, "Well, I've got a McDonald's on the way, you know, a McDonald's early on, and I'll get a salty McMuffin or something like that." And I saw him suddenly as he was a 12 grand a year man. That's what his salary was. And I'm paying him 43,000, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I'm having to say to that individual, he's coming up to me and saying, "God, I had a great meal the other night." "Where?" "Oh, this Michelin star restaurant." And then the challenge to me was to say to him, "Look, you're putting on weight, mate. Your body mass is, you know, we're going to start weighing referees." Those sort of the disciplines that you had to introduce, because they were taking the money, but they weren't recognizing what professional
meant.
And, you know, and then, of course, you had individual personalities who would work hard. So I think that refereeing is always going to be a mix. I think that it's difficult for the modern referees, but then that's why they're professional.
Yeah.
And this is why preparation is so important, but also leadership. You touched on leadership beginning. When you've got a group of guys and you're saying, "Look, we're going to highlight on the errors." They hated me standing up in front of them with a big screen playing video clips. I think even Howard Webb in his book said he didn't like the process.
Yeah.
But what you do is you say to the referee in that room, "It's your mistake here. Talk me through how you came to that decision."
Mm-hmm.
You're not being dishonest. You might be lazy. You've come to the wrong, you've got the right, the wrong outcome. Why? Tell me why. And it'd be so, "Well, if I'd have moved wider, I'd have got a better view," or "I really didn't see that." All those aspects coming in. But then you'd have referees, their own colleagues saying, "Look, you need to move here." You know, I mean, I think after the infamous case of Mike Riley standing a few yards away from a fullback at Arsenal, saying, "Come here," and the player refuses, I showed that clip. And I can always remember Jeff Winter, who's a referee at the time, saying to Mike Riley, "You need to get a pair of them that count, mate. You know, you need to get a bit of steel in you. You're too soft, Bonnie lad." And that, I think, is a greater impact than actually saying, "Look, it's not a public execution here.
Yeah.
It's learning how you can overcome those errors." And, you've got different skill sets in that room. So I think that aspect of coaching and leadership is so important. I think it's good that they've now brought Howard Webb in. He's an ex-copper. He says it as it is, an outstanding referee. And he will grow up with them and develop them and sort them out. But the reality is this: you have to have the strength to be able to say you're not good enough. You have to have the knowledge to say,
"Yes,
what are your weaknesses? I'm going to address them."
Mm-hmm.
And if that individual says, "I'm too good for that and I don't want to know those weaknesses," then you have to offload
very
quickly. And you have to be just like that manager of Premier League team who's brought a player in and he might have paid a few million quid for him and he suddenly thinks he can't slot in because he can't make that step change
that transition
at the elite level. So I think there's over recent years insufficient churn, lack of competitiveness.
Right.
You know, I developed and was very happy to have within the group of referees three different groups.
Right.
Different personalities, different leaders within those groups, but a competitive edge.
And
if I didn't give a referee, I can remember Mark Halsey, I didn't give him a game one weekend. He knocked on my door. Why haven't I got a game? Am I off form? Am I not refereeing well? All those sort of things. And you say, look, I've only got 10 appointments, Mark. I've got 16, 18 referees.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the current situation? And excuse me for being a little bit autobiographical here because it irritates me personally and I don't know if it bothers anybody else, but one of the things that really, really I can't get on with is the fact that, to me now, Keith, it seems in the game that cheating is okay. And what I mean by that in terms of how it manifests is players, for me, absolutely obviously fall over whenever they feel any kind of contact, or they try and fall over because the advantages of gaining a penalty are so enormous. And I believe that the game, the people who make the laws of the game, you know, FIFA, UEFA, AFC, all the rest of it, and the referee, the people who control the referees, I think that they now accept, as do the pundits, that it is okay to fall over to gain a penalty when it's not a foul. That I actually believe that. And I think that we are teaching young people to cheat. That I absolutely believe that, Keith. And I've got, and you can look at Match of the Day, you can look at, you know, listen to any podcast, look at any BBC program, and you'll see people on hundreds of thousands of pounds a year who've been, you know, who are icons of the game, Lineker and Shearer and all the rest of them, and they will say, oh, it's a definite penalty. And I fundamentally disagree with so much of that. I think we now allow cheating, period.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right, and it frustrates me as much as it probably frustrates you. You know, when I listen to the leadership or lack of leadership that says a player can hold an opponent, but it's not really a pull, that's allowable, or a player falls over, it's not. I can remember, and this was happening in my time, I think it's grown worse. I can remember, I used to meet the managers pre-season in three groups. I gave three dates, three different venues to make certain that they did come, and they had to come anyway, otherwise they'd be fined. I can remember standing up on one occasion saying, look, we've got a cancer in the game that's really troubling me. And I'm going to tell you now, I'm going to show you some film clips. And there's decisions here that should be penalty kicks that's been given. And there's some that's not, that should have been given. There's some that should not have been given because they're not penalty kicks, because they're not fouls. And I said to them, I'll be very honest with you. Your players are getting that good that one week you'll get a penalty kick, the next week you'll get nothing, and you'll be frustrated. The image of the game is being tarnished. The image of this league, which is transmitted to 211 territories around the world, is being damaged because we're setting an example that shouldn't be set. So I'm very clear that football as a whole, not just referees, the administrators, the managers, you know, the LMA, the PFA, they've allowed this to happen. Now, the first point is, you know, I can remember having a discussion with Sam Allardyce who said, here's a foul, and the player didn't go down. And I went, yes, it is a foul. It should have been a penalty kick. The referee didn't give the penalty kick on the basis of when I examined, he didn't go down, so I wasn't giving it. So, in a way, that starts to evolve. That if you get a tug, go down because you're going to get a shot on goal, better chances. It's like You know, there are a number of issues in the game where ultimately the referees have been allowed to be weak because the leadership's allowed them to be weak, but the laws and the administrators have allowed it to happen. So as a consequence, one of the issues that's been ongoing for a number of years is grappling. You know, and it's not me that started that word. I had an involvement in it. It was Hugh McIlvenny, a well-known journalist, who rang me one day and said, "Mr. Hackett," in a I think a Scottish accent, "you're allowing the game to be besmirched by the actions of players in the penalty area. This is a game of skill, not a game of strength. You're allowing the outlaws to win." That was his conversation, a very articulate man. Grappling is getting worse. And what we've seen evolve is, we've seen that weak approach, haven't we? The referee goes in and says, "Stop it, come out," and then it still continues.
Just carries on.
In the same way that diving. Now, I have to say this, that the skill set of the player has greatly enhanced in terms of going down to ground.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's a Francis Lee times 10 now.
Yeah. And what you have is you have players clicking the boots. You have players who hang out the leg to hook their opponent. They are making contact with their opponent, knowing full well that their intention is to go to ground. The only way that you will resolve this issue is as football body as a whole to say, look, we have a problem. It's tarnishing the image of the game, and we need to resolve the issue. First of all, if referees see it, we want it punishing. If there is doubt, it needs to be reviewed. You know, and I applaud one guy, Gordon Johnson, when he became, for a very short time, the head of the Scottish FA. Within a matter of weeks of him being in post, he said, "We're going to go for a review process on these. We're going to issue retrospective punishment for divers." He, as a football player, didn't like it. So, as a consequence, he brought it in. And then the lawmakers, I think, are a bit anti it. They don't like games re-refereed. The only way that you will resolve the issue to some degree is to start to punish retrospectively players who do this. But that doesn't resolve the issue of, you know, a penalty kick not being awarded, you know. And I was hoping that with the introduction of VAR, that VAR itself would act as a deterrent. But, of course, the criteria to some degree has been weakened by when it can intervene.
Yes.
Because this whole question is clear and obvious error to the referee. And, you know, sometimes it is a subjective decision, element. So the lawmakers themselves can start to address the issue by using the terminology and the words to actually define the action, rather than leaving it open as a subjective decision that has a degree of tolerance within it. You know, I mean, in a way, it's a little bit like the mess they make of handball, and now we're all confused.
It's awful.
Because what they've done is they've decided, let's play around with the laws and make it clearer, and in fact have made it more foggier in its approach, because what they've done is they've taken away the key issue, the key word
is
deliberate
intention.
And all you have to say is, right, this referee, the laws of the game, handball, it's a deliberate action, hand moving to ball, right? And you know, when you get into, is he wide or is he not, Let's make an individual judgment. But at the moment, what we're trying to do is define it, and then cover every attitude. So
it's too black. It's not black and white, is it, Keith? It's not as black and white as it. It's too low resolution.
Well, I say to young referees, which is the policeman that you admire? The one who stops you when you've done 31 miles an hour and issues you with a ticket, or the one that stops you at 31 miles an hour and says, don't do it again? The one that communicates with you.
Correct.
You know, and I think to some degree, what we've got to understand is, at 32, mate, you're done.
Yeah.
And with handball or with holding or with diving, it's the same. If you allow the tolerance level to go out to like 35, 36, where it's sitting at the moment, all we're doing is opening up the view, which really, really concerns me. And that is the fan starts to question the integrity of the referee, not his competence, but his integrity. I'll question the competence. I don't question their integrity because I'm confident the systems that I helped put in place, the history of our game in England, it wouldn't be tolerated. But the modern fan, the youngster now, who sees corruption on the screens of social media, suddenly the referees are corrupt. This is a corrupt referee, you know. And I think that fans have to understand that no matter how good a referee you are, you're human, you're going to make mistakes. And, you know, it's this, you know, we require the referee to give a post-match interview. For what? Because what he's going to be asked is not that wonderful advantage that you played in the 55th minute that added to a goal. It's going to be, why didn't you award a free kick here? Or why didn't, you know, the minutiae outweighs. Whereas what I used to say to referees is, look, I had a system where they marked out of 100. But if they made a key major incident error, it was 59. And everybody said that is that was the maximum mark they could get.
Yeah.
And they've concentrated on that. And that's what I wanted them to do, because what it said is, up here, don't make a big error.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Your referee performance is not judged by, you know, the throwing. You know, this nonsense that comes out from the PGMOL on occasions, which is like somebody said to me the other week, well, you know, the guys are 98%, 99% correct in decision-making. It's wonderful achievement, you know. And I'm going, what? 98, 99. I said, well, yeah, throw-ins, free kicks, corner kicks, goal kicks, all go into that mix of 98%. That's not what the game's about.
No.
Is it a penalty kick? Is it a penalty kick? Is it not? Did that referee, could he have controlled that? I'll give you an example. I say to young referees, you're putting the kettle on the gas fire, right? The kettle's there and it's got cold water in it. That's the start of the game. What you've got to do is the game, it wants to bubble. The water wants to be bubble. Because if we've got a game that's bubbly, that's the game that everybody wants to see. That's the game we love. The intensity, the passion, and to some degree, not the brutality, but some of the tough challenges, right? But when the steam starts emitting, you've got to turn the gas down.
Yeah.
And that's when you've got to start to interfere. But the skill of your judgment is, at what point is it going to go to steam, or at what point is it really bubbling? And that's when your interference comes in. And you start to squeeze the tolerance down. That's a free kick. Stop play. Delay it slightly. That's a free kick. Stop play. Delay it. And just like the equestrian rider who comes into the show ring with a horse, the horse is in control, really, because it can do what it likes. But what does he do? He asks the horse to come back two or three paces, because what he's saying is, all right, we're in the big ring here. I want you to focus. And in a way, this is where good coaching in refereeing can go in at half time.
Yeah,
and say, look, from my perspective here, I've got the whole book in front of me. You're just seeing the chapters. I need you to really get involved now. I need you to step up a gear. And you start to see the tolerance level. But also, if that referee doesn't prepare, if I was going in to referee Manchester City and Franny Lee was playing, I knew that he was a diver. What was my job? My job was to run alongside and say, look, I'm not awarding 10 out of 10 for any dives today. You get the first one in.
Yeah, yeah.
They look at you and go, you're prejudging. You're not prejudging. You're managing. But that, you know, or the player alongside you and say, you're a shit referee. You're having a used, hopeless game. Hey, just a minute. Let's hold on. How bad are you? You've just made two or three passes. Are you telling me that I'm, you know? And
yeah.
I think this is the working environment in which you're operating, where you as an individual have to adjust, but you've also got to prejudge the players in front of you. The one who, if you enter the zone into their area, would not be happy. You know, get out, you get away from it. The one who, you know, that if you pull him to you, wouldn't appreciate it. So I think it's knowledge, understanding, the boss actually saying, look, there are areas that you need to improve.
I think, you know, what you're saying, Keith, in all this, the principles that kind of run through this, you're talking about balance, you're talking about a balanced view. And you're also alluding very much to what we often come back to in the podcast about skills with people and understanding people, no matter what your professional area or environment. Ultimately, so much of it seems to go back to how you are with people, how you communicate. And I think that's a big thing that's come through. Absolutely. Just kind of look, I'm very, very appreciative of your time here. I just wanted to talk about grassroots because, you know, you've mentioned that already, Keith. From what you're saying, there's still a challenge getting people to referee. And I've seen it too many times. You know, a young person in the teens trying to deal with the confrontation of, you know, a few feisty 11, 12-year-olds plus, you know, 26 parents or guardians. It's like, I wonder people don't carry on, Keith, when you've seen what goes on. What would you like to see change to bring that to a better place, if that's not a silly question?
Well, I mean, initially, there's such a shortfall. There's about a 10% shortfall of referees, and I think that has to be a concern. And one of the things is that, you know, to become a referee, you've got to spend about 150 quid just on a course.
Mm.
That seems to me to be too high a fence to leap. And therefore, probably taking away the opportunity of that 26-year-old who's decided, I'm, you know, a grassroots player who thinks I'm going to hang my boots up, and you lose him other than he goes and watches professional football. Whereas you want to keep him in the game. And therefore, I think you've got to say, look, if you've played for a club for X number of years, you can become a referee and the course should be free. I think those aspects, you know, are important. Then what you've got to try and do is attract the right people into the game. I think that, in a way, we've somehow got to recognise there are two games in this country. There's grassroots and there's professional. And there has to be a slightly different approach. I think from the top end, they've got to actually say, you know, when academy players fail to meet that level of understanding and requirement, we have to say, can we capture some of those individuals who've gone through 2, 3, 4, 5 years of understanding the game as a player, i.e. reading the game, being physically fit, understanding players and all that goes with it. Can we actually get those certain a number of those to become referees or put them on a course to become referees? From a grassroots level point of view, I think the first thing that I would encourage clubs to do, grassroots club, is to have a referee mentor or a referee guardian, so that as a club, we're going to play a game of football. We need a contact point that is looking after the referee. So that if that referee is being confronted in the park or whatever, that experienced guy who might be in his 50s, 60s can go up and tap a parent and say, look, calm down. He's only a young girl or young lad. Give him the chance. But I think it's down to this mentoring coaching.
Right.
I mean, I watch a guy in North in, I mean, I'm still very much connected with grassroots football now more than ever. I have to say, even when I refereed at international level, I might referee Germany one weekend or in midweek, and the following Saturday, two pub teams. I've always done that.
I love that.
So that's always been my case. And now I'm president of Penistone Church. We have we play in the Northern Counties East League. And I stay away from the playing bit. I look at the administration and all that. We've got 20 teams. And I'm also president of the Northern Counties League. So from that point of view, my contact with football is still there and important. And I think that what needs to be done is, I think that first bit is that when they're youngsters, they should be refereeing in the academies. They should be encouraged to referee in the academies where it's a relatively protected environment.
Mm.
They're not going to be physically abused. They might be occasionally verbally abused, but there's less physicality about it. But I think it's a tough task and a tough ask for the FA, because I think that sometimes we've also got people who are less patient. I mean, I was 12 years. I can remember after about 8 years, I got called in by the county FA secretary. I thought I'd done wrong. And the guy sat me down and said, right, I've just read the local newspaper, Mr. Hackett, and they're actually suggesting that you might be a Football League referee in the future. Well, that might be the case, but I'll tell you, the next 5 years, you're not going to get anywhere near it, son. in a way, it was like it was a good talk, because it suddenly go, you know, it didn't dampen my enthusiasm. It brought a reality to it.
A reality check. Yeah.
So what you've got now is you've got, and I still talk and chat to a lot of referees at grassroots level. It's almost like I've been doing this for 3 years now, and I really ought to be at a higher level, And what we're trying to do is we've put all these like 12 steps to get to the top level.
Yeah,
there's only three, and I think the expectation is that it's all right having these 12 fences or seven, whatever it is. You know, you're this level, you're that level, you're next level, and all that goes with it. What it does is it acts as a barrier, because they're actually promoting disappointment. There's an high expectation. I want to become, you know, in my year, it was class three, class two, class one. That was it. But now with all these classifications, you talk to a lot. I've been on 2 years and I haven't been promoted.
Mm.
You know, and so I think the system needs, you always say the system needs review. It's all right putting these tears up, referee that, you know. But what's happening is this. The reality of it is, you've got a kid who's been refereeing a year, and all of a sudden he gets a phone call because the team, four levels higher, are short of somebody.
Mm.
You know, our league this weekend, I think, are about six or eight assistant referees short at a reasonably high standard. So we might just get somebody who's been running the line or refereeing for about a year and a half on a line in front of 400 or 500 spectators. So yeah. I'm sure the people who are running football have an awareness, but what they've got to do is they've got to try and stop the numbers game and actually look at the individual and track that individual with all the modern methods that they've got and say, look, this is what your expectation is. Not just say, it's down to you how you train. It's down to you how you physically train. It's down to you how you evolve. Because, I mean, I've looked at some young referees. I mean, I can remember 2 or 3 years ago, I went on the pitch to defend a referee.
Right.
He was about 16 years old. The ball had been headed back to the goalkeeper who caught it, who booted it upfield. And the manager of one of the teams, and I wasn't involved in either team, I was watching another game, suddenly he's confronting the referee face-to-face on the pitch, saying, that's a passback.
Yeah.
And I'm going like, that's not a passback, mate, you're wrong. And eventually the young referee blows his whistle and he's almost in tears and walking off when I get involved and suddenly go, what's the problem? It's a passback. No, it's not. So I've explained the law to him. I've said to the young referee, and he's going, no, I'm going home. And his mother was on the touchline, and his uncle. It happened that his uncle, believe it or not, was a Football League linesman, and I knew him.
Wow.
And it was quite amazing coincidence. But I've said to the parent, look, just calm him down a bit. We'll give him a cup of tea. We'll just I don't want him to go away now. I said, well, if he walks away now, he's finished.
Yeah.
And he went back on and refereed.
Blessing.
I think it's difficult for us to understand just how difficult it is now to become a referee and now evolved. And I'm openly critical of referees at the elite level because my expectations and demands are greater, knowing that look, you're earning £100,000 a year, not 35 quid a week. That's not a jealousy thing. That is about delivery. The fact that, you know, I can remember the meetings of, I could have just walked away, but I went and saw Sir Dave Richards, who was chairman of the Premier League. I've retired at 50. I'm now assessing. But you've got to get referees professional. Why?
Yeah.
Because the physical demands of the modern game are such, the preparation has to be better.
Yeah.
And you need to actually train these guys. You know, when I can remember when I introduced a sprint coach into the PGMOL and I brought this sprint coach in and said, right, okay. The guy started having to do the explosive sprinting.
Yeah.
And I stood up and said, look, the dynamics of the game has changed. It's gone from endurance, my era. It's now moving into explosive sprinting and the demands on you are going to be physically greater from a sprint point of view. And therefore, when I see referees now who are lazy and they're not meeting that criteria, then we're not advancing. Being blunt, under the management and leadership of Mike Riley, lack of leadership by Riley, I do think that refereeing has gone back. I think against that, we've had a succession planning point, problem, holding on to referees too long when, in fact, they should be given other roles within the organisation. But, hey, you can always put the world to right, and it's easy to sit and do it.
Absolutely.
But I do think, ultimately, at the end of the day, that we've got to look at Webb as being the guy. Hopefully he'll hold the job down and improve things.
Beautiful. Keith, I could speak to you till the cows come home with your life experience. It's been a beautiful conversation. We've managed to talk about the elite game. We've managed to touch on some great experiences that you've had yourself, which illuminate things so well. I've indulged myself asking you a few questions that I was interested in. We've talked about leadership. We've talked about the grassroots. We've talked about the laws of the game. We've talked about the current issues. And we've talked about how you think things can hopefully be improved. So, look, I can't thank you enough. It's been a wonderful conversation and absolutely great. I'd recommend that people have a look at your books that I know are available on Amazon. Yeah, and you're on LinkedIn, Keith. Yeah, so is it all right if I put your LinkedIn
absolutely
on the bio?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Contact you. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Good.
Maybe. Beautiful. Well, thanks for your time, Keith. It's been
pleasure.
Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. Sorry.
Well, what a wonderful conversation that was, and I can't thank Keith enough for his input. We covered so much about the beautiful game and being no doubt that talking to somebody with that amount of experience, decades and decades of committed experience from true grassroots through to the elite professional level, and even after retirement being seemingly as active as before, experiencing working two jobs, experiencing the early days, the inaugural period of the Premier League, and the astronomical rise of football in terms of world spectatorship, and still active, still eloquent, still passionate and honest and courageous and willing to say things that resonate so well with certainly myself and leader manager coach Keith. It was a wonderful discussion. I hope whether you're involved in grassroots, you're involved in the professional game, you just love the game, you're a leader, a manager, a coach, you can get something out of that. There was so much in it. We talked about balance. We talked about controlling ego. We talked about communication, dealing with criticism. And it was just a blessing to listen to someone also with so much humility, who has rubbed shoulders truly with the greats. You know, somebody who's been on a professional sports arena with the likes of Pelé and Maradona and so on is worthy of listening to. Keith Hackett, thank you very much. Leader, manager, coach, fill your boots. Catch you later. Bye-bye.